a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
The police released their only suspect in the mass murder of film star Sharon Tate and four others.
Late last night, another bizarre murder in Los Angeles, the second in 2 days. The owner of a small supermarket chain found in his home, his head covered by a white hood, a meat fork stuck in his chest. His wife, 38-year-old Mrs. Lino LaBianca, found in the bedroom dead, her back brutally cut by a whip.
He's inside, two bodies outside.
They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs.
Were lurid. The movie actress was Sharon Tate, 26. The others were a male hairdresser, the heiress to a coffee fortune, a writer, and a boy just out of high school.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and six others. Those arrested are two women and one man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. Five women are being held as material witnesses.
They called themselves the family.
Los Angeles has had another multiple murder. Last night, a middle-aged couple was stabbed to death in a case that has striking similarities to the mass murder Saturday of actress Sharon Tate and four friends.
We're taking dope and stealing cars and they just sit around all day and sleep. And that's about it. And we went around collecting garbage and had that for dinner and went to the store once in a while. And that was about it. They just slept and got loaded.
People who lived with Manson on the ranch and in the desert denied that they were a violent group. They called themselves the family.
Who was playing? That's what the whole thing is, that we were doing out there was playing. You know.
Well, what kind of guy was Charlie?
He's a good person. Very good person. He's got a lot of peace.
Was he out there all the time?
I don't even know. You know, he'd take off over mountains and just like a deer. And he just wandered around.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
On his body, the word war had been carved in the chest. Then, with blood, the killer had scrawled on a refrigerator door the words, death to pigs.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our ninth look at Charles Manson and his family. Before we get going, we have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on any social media, that would be Facebook, Instagram, MeWe, Twitter, YouTube. You just search for Ian Totten, author, or The Deathcast, or Corpse Creek Publishing. If you would like to sign up for the show's official mailing list to get updates on what's going on with the show, as well as with my written works, you can go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com, click on the sign up button. While there, please consider making a donation to the show to help offset the costs of producing it. Buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of smokes. Let me know how you think I'm doing. If you would really like to help the show, there's a couple ways you can do that. First is you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe there, and leave a 5-star review, share the show on social media, that sort of thing. If you leave a 5-star review, I will read it out live on air. Secondly, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon for as little as $2 a month. You can help offset the cost of producing the show, as well as get access to exclusive content. Now that that is all out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go to the crypt. When we left off last week, the Manson family had just killed the LaBianca family at their home. This was the night after the murders of Sharon Tate and her friends on August 10th of 1969. and we were talking about the various theories that the police were investigating in an effort to try and figure out who could possibly be responsible for the murders, the media was quick to connect the two crimes, although it did take law enforcement some time before they realized or admitted that the crimes were committed by the same individuals. Part of this is because both crime scenes fell into different jurisdictions. It's one of the things that people don't understand about Los Angeles is that there are numerous different jurisdictions and police and sheriff's departments operating within the city, and even moving over so much as a block in any direction can take a crime from one jurisdiction and place it into the other. And also at this time, police departments were really hesitant to share information on various crimes with one another, not just federal law enforcement, but also with, you know, other police departments or sheriff's departments. As with the Tate murders, the officers involved in the LaBianca killings really kept no holdback information, which was really to their detriment. On Saturday, August 16th, 1969, unbeknownst to everyone at Spahn Ranch, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department were preparing for a raid. Now, there is some evidence and stories out there that Manson had foreknowledge of this raid, be it from his probation officer or, if you believe the individuals who suspect that Manson was possibly a part of the MK Ultra project, then his handlers in that shadowy world. What is known is that more than 100 deputies swarmed the ranch at just after 6 a.m. on the 16th, and at least 26 different individuals were arrested during this raid on charges from grand theft, assault with a deadly weapon, and burglary. Of those arrested, and I'm taking this list directly from charlesmanson.com, were Charles Manson, Richard Allen Smith, John Harold Schwartz, Sandra Pugh, Leslie Owens, Nancy Pittman, Larry Craven, Barbara Weiner, Carol Matthews, Marianne Scott, Ruth Ann Smith, Shirley Amanda McCoy, Lynette Frome, John Flynn, Robert Reinhard, Grant Mullen, David Hanem, Julia Roberts, Sadie Mae Glutz, who, as we all know, was Susan Atkins, along with a host of other individuals. At this point, I'm going to read the affidavit in support and petition for the search warrant, which was granted on the 13th of August. A personal appeared before me this 13th day of August, 1969, the affiant, William C. Gleason, a peace officer who on oath makes complaint and deposes and says that he has and there is probable and reasonable cause to believe and that he does believe that there is now on the premise located and also described as 12,000 Santa Susana Road, Chatsworth, commonly known as Spahn Movie Ranch, consisting of approximately 200 acres of open ranch land, including all buildings, storage rooms, vehicles, garages, and outbuildings of any kind located thereon, and on the persons of Charles Miles Manson, a.k.a. Charles Miles Summers, 5'7" in height, weight 140 pounds, brown hair, brown eyes, date of birth 11/11/34, with attached tattoo of a woman's head on each arm and a 1-inch scar over his left eye. The following personal property, to wit, stolen automobile parts included but not limited to Volkswagen frames, engines, transmissions, and carts thereof, and rifles, automatic pistols, and rifles. Your affiant says that there is probability and reasonable cause to believe, and that he does believe that the said property constitutes stolen or embezzled property, property of things used as the means of committing a felony, property of things in the possession of a person with the intent to use it as a means of committing a public offense, or in the possession of another to whom he may have delivered it for the purpose of concealing it or preventing it being discovered, property or things which consist of an item or constitutes evidence which tends to show that a felony has been committed or tends to show that a particular person has committed a felony. Your affiant has been a deputy sheriff for the past 10.5 years, employed in such capacity by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, and has acted and received the information set forth in this affidavit in that capacity. Your affiant is now and has been for the past 15 months assigned to the Technical Services Division thereof. On the date of August 9, 1969, your affiant and Sergeant Douglas at Sarah's Station contacted Officer Ted Lee, number 4907, Los Angeles Police Department, Devonshire Division, Julian Bureau. Lee stated that he flew over the Spahn Movie Ranch approximately August 1, 1969, and at that time he observed a 1969 Volkswagen lying in a ditch southwest of the main ranch complex. Since that date, Lee has determined the Volkswagen to be a stolen vehicle. It is a Volkswagen that was taken from the Dick Joyce Volkswagen Agency in Van Nuys, reported stolen July 15, 1969, under file number DR69. TAC-052-TAC-838. The vehicle was unregistered at the time, but bore identification number 119-TAC-766-TAC-041. Lee stated that the vehicle was further identified by Officer Slauson and Despain, Los Angeles Police Department, Devonshire Division Patrol, who walked into location, checked the vehicle, but did not impound it. Devonshire Division Detective Noyler is handling that investigation. Officer Lee also stated that he was at the Spahn Ranch on approximately July 21, 1969 with Homicide Bureau Sergeant Shuland and De La Fuentes, who were conducting the murder investigation of Mark Volts, male Caucasian 16, whose body was found in Malibu Station area recently. Officer Lee observed a new gasoline tank for a Volkswagen in the corral at this location. He also observed a gray Volkswagen microbus on the property. The bus is equipped with a two-way radio. Officer Lee has received 3 loaded Panama clips for a 30-caliber carbine, which were found on or about July 29, 1969, by Devonshire Division patrol officers. The clips apparently fell from a dune buggy while on the highway. Officer Lee has contacted by the person known as Charles Manson, mentioned in prior memos. Manson told Lee that the clips belonged to him, but as yet has not picked up the clips from Officer Lee. Sergeant Douglas and your affiant also contacted Officer Williams, number 13814, LAPD, Devonshire Division. Officer Williams stated that within the last 2 weeks, he and his partner were on duty at the Spahn Ranch in a marked police vehicle. The officers were talking with Charles Manson, and Mr. Manson was bragging to the officers about the weapons available to him and his friends at the ranch. Mr. Manson told the officers that while he was talking to the officers, that his friends had rifles trained on the officers. Also, Manson indicated that this is standard procedure whenever officers approach the ranch. On August 10, 1969, your affiant proceeded to Devonshire Division Detective Bureau and checked a recent arrest package of the above mentioned Charles Manson. He was booked June 4, 1969 on a rape charge. This arrest was the outgrowth of a rape that occurred at the Spahn Ranch and is being handled by Malibu Station. Manson was booked in Devonshire Division case number DR-TAC-69-TAC-469-TAC-997 assigned. During the interview by the investigators, Manson told the officers he was on federal parole for Grand Theft Auto, and he stated he has served time in Terminal Island and McNeil Island Federal Prison. On August 10, 1969, Jerafian contacted the owners of the above-mentioned dune buggy shop at 10202 Topeka Canyon, Chatsworth. The business is named Butler's Buggy Shop. Phone number redacted. It is owned by Phil and Dale Butler. Phil Butler is a Los Angeles police officer assigned to Valley Services Division Jail. Dale Butler is the manager of the location and knows Charles Manson. Dale Butler said he has always conducted business with Manson on a cash basis. Charles Manson recently purchased two dune buggies for location, paying for both in the amount of $2,300 and $100 bills. Dale Butler said Manson normally carries large sums of money. Manson recently purchased a dune buggy without an engine from Dale Butler. Further on in this affidavit, it's mentioned how Manson had sold vehicles to Butler's buggy shop, and that friends of his had also sold vehicles to them, as well as information that members of the Satan Slaves Motorcycle Club were known affiliates of Manson, and that members of this organization had been observed at the ranch. And this is a part of the story that is often glossed over, this relationship between Manson and this biker gang. It is known that Manson would pimp his girls out to members of the Satan Slaves. It's also known that there were periods of time where members of the organization came to the ranch and forcibly raped members of Manson's family, just simply because they thought that it was their right to do so. What is also known, however, is that there were members of this organization who were understandably fearful of Manson. Also discussed within the affidavit were numerous instances of officers going over and interacting with various members of the family, ostensibly in an effort to determine the size of the group of inhabitants that were there, although it should be noted that officers were never able to make contact with everyone who was on the ranch, as they were scattered throughout the vast area that the ranch took up. So you have all of this information that the LAPD Sheriff's Department was in possession of, and not only was, you know, one substation of the LAPD Sheriff's Department in possession of it, numerous different substations throughout the area were aware of what Manson and his family were getting involved with. Mind you, Manson is a federal felon who's out on parole. Despite this, when the raid happened and the individuals at the ranch were taken into custody, it was in very short order that they were released again back to the ranch to do with as they pleased, with no real reason ever being given as to why they were released. You would think that a convicted felon in possession of stolen vehicles, large amounts of cash, as well as narcotics and weaponry would, you know, basically be locked up until his hearing date, along with those that were with him. However, Manson is not the case, as has been shown time and again. Anytime he got into trouble with anything, he was released in fairly quick order to go back about his business, as were many of his followers, most notable being Susan Atkins, who was arrested numerous times after coming under Manson's influence. But every time that she was arrested, a lawyer was found, or Manson would get his parole officer to intercede, and she was released. This is one of the many, many reasons that individuals who follow the conspiracies about Manson believe that there was some shenanigans going on. Some people have called it black ops, that Manson was in fact a sleeper agent of the CIA, possibly put into the position and protected as he was in an effort to discredit and disrupt the entire hippie movement in not only California, but across the country. There is some good evidence that supports that, as well as when you'll see when Manson actually is arrested for the murders out at the Barker Ranch. The headlines screamed about, you know, homicidal hippies and psychotic hippie gurus, that sort of a thing. And it is not outside of the realm of possibility that members of the intelligence community inside the United States told the newspapers what headlines to print or gave them suggestions for the headlines. There is mountains of evidence as well as witness testimony from people both in the intelligence community as well as in news organizations stating that they have liaisons with both the CIA and the FBI who help them to decide which stories to run, spins to put on certain stories, that sort of thing. So again, it's not outside the realm of possibility that all of these newspapers across the country were instructed on how they should report on this particular case. After being released, Manson is said to have become exceedingly paranoid over the police surveillance of the ranch, which is understandable to some degree. One individual whom Manson decided was more probable than not responsible for he and the family's arrest was a man by the name of Donald Shorty Shea, who was a stuntman and also worked at the Spahn Ranch. Manson had had confrontations with Shea prior to the raid on the ranch, but after being released, Manson became convinced that Shea had sold them out to the police. He decided that Shea had to be murdered as retribution for this. So on August 26th of 1969, Manson got Bruce Davis, Tex Watson, and Steve Grogan together and told them to ask Shea to give them a ride to another part of the ranch where a car parts storage facility was located. Davis said that he sat in the back seat with Grogan, who hit Shea in the head with a pipe wrench as Watson began to stab him. Quote, "I was in the car when Steve Grogan hit Shorty with the pipe wrench. Charles Watson stabbed him. I was in the back seat with Grogan. They took Shorty out. They had to go down the hill to a place. I stayed in the car for quite a while, but what? Then I went down the hill later on, and that's when I cut Shorty on the shoulder with the knife after he was, well, I don't know. I don't know if he was dead or not. He didn't bleed when I cut him on the shoulder. When I showed up, you know, he was incapacitated. I don't know if you ask if he was unconscious. I don't know. He may or may not have been. He didn't seem conscious. He wasn't moving or saying anything, and it started off. Manson handed me a machete as if I was supposed to. I mean, I know what he wanted, but you know I couldn't do that. And I did touch Shorty Shea with a machete on the back of the neck. Didn't break the skin. I mean, I just couldn't do it. And then I threw the knife, and he handed me a bayonet, and I just reached over. I don't know which side it was on, but I cut him right above here on the shoulder, just with the tip of the blade. Sort of like saying, are you satisfied, Charlie? And I turned and around and walked away, and I was sick for about 2 or 3 days. I mean, I couldn't even think about what I had done. There is another theory out there concerning the murder of Shorty Shea, and that one concerns Manson supposedly having been beaten by Shea before moving on to Spahn Ranch. This was when Manson lived at the Gresham Street home in Canoga Park. Manson shared this house with Bill Vance. We will get back to that in just a moment. From Ian Totten, best-selling author, The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gods Trilogy, Maggie. A book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie. The name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie. Who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers. Quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. E-book pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
We are back. Now, as I was saying, Manson shared this home with Bill Vance. As the story goes, another ranch hand at Spahn Ranch by the name of Randy Starr was involved with Manson. And Randy's wife, a woman by the name of Wendy Buckley, was lending Manson her van, unaware that this vehicle was being used by Manson and Vance to commit robberies. As this particular story goes, when Wendy discovered that police had linked her truck to this string of burglaries, she confronted Manson and informed him that he would no longer be allowed to borrow the truck. At which point, Manson and Vance supposedly beat the woman. Supposedly, Shorty Shea found out about this and showed up at the house and beat both Manson and Vance, warning them both that they had better stay away from the ranch. This particular tale likes to paint Shorty Shea as something of a tough guy badass, which is in direct contradiction to everything I have ever read concerning him. In any event, after this supposed incident happened, Manson and the family ends up moving on to the ranch, and Manson charged another one of his followers, a man by the name of Larry Bailey, with spying on Shea. Supposedly, Buckley was caught by Shorty Shea, at which time he was stripped naked and tied to a tree facing the main road. This was done in an effort to send a message to Manson and his other acolytes. I don't believe any of this ever happened. Really, I haven't seen any evidence to prove that this happens. Again, to me, this smacks of revisionist history of someone trying to make Shorty Shea out to be something more than what he actually was. Every account I have ever encountered of Shea says that he did not like Manson, but was in fact fearful of him and his family, as he could sense that there was something off with him. And I can't see Shea, no matter how much of a badass he may have thought he was, going and doing something like this in an attempt to warn off Manson, when it has been well documented that Manson had no problem ordering violence and even participating in such violence. I can't see a ranch hand, you know, willingly spurring on a convicted felon by assaulting one of his followers. I think if this were to have happened, the retribution from Manson and the family would have been swift and violent. In any event, whichever reason it was, I like to believe that it was that Shea, fearful of Manson, what he and his followers were doing, as well as the influence he saw them wielding over George Spahn, contacted the police. They murdered him, and according to Bruce Davis and Clem Grogan, both Bill Vance and Larry Bailey were also present when Shea was murdered. Later, a member of the family by the name of Barbara Hoyt recounted during grand jury testimony that she had heard screams on the night in question, which prompted her to leave the family, fearing that she might be next. According to Hoyt, quote, "It was about 10 p.m. when I heard a long, loud, blood-curdling scream. Then it went quiet for a minute or so, and the screams came again and again. It seemed to go on forever. I have no doubt that Shorty was being murdered at that time." After he was murdered, Shea's body was buried in a shallow grave on the ranch, while his 1962 Mercury was driven out and left in, from what I can surmise, it was a wash of some type with a footlocker containing Shorty's possessions. Now, rumors went through the family after his murder that he had been brutally tortured prior to being executed, and that he was still alive when members of the family began to bisect and dissect him, with ultimately Shea's body supposedly being hacked into 9 pieces. I say supposedly because when his body was eventually exhumed in the late 1970s, while it did show signs of being cut and hacked on, particularly on the shoulders and chest, there were no signs that chunks of his body had been cut off. After this murder, Manson led his followers away from Spahn Ranch to another location, which they had been using since 1968. Two ranches located in Death Valley National Park, the Myers and Barker Ranch. There were buildings on both of these ranches, and Manson was able to get permission from Catherine Gillies, who was the granddaughter of Barbara Myers, to use the camps. Now, if you've ever seen pictures of these ranches, to say that they are in a desolate place is an understatement. And really, the only way to get up there is by going up Gore Wash, which has extremely high sides and is boulder strewn. When I say boulder, I am talking massive boulders, the kind where you would have to climb them in order to get on top of them. And this is pretty significant when you consider the fact that the family not only got all of their worldly possessions up to the Barker Ranch, they also got their dune buggies as well as the black school bus that the family drove around in up into Barker Ranch. It's actually still there, out sitting out in the middle of the desert. And just as an aside, would that I had the money. That is probably the one place on the planet that I would move to, is Death Valley, not in the national park, but further east, just because I think it's gorgeous and I enjoy the heat like you have no idea. And again, it's massively desolate, which would allow me the time to focus on my various projects, i.e. writing and this podcast. In any event, Manson and his followers moved up there, and while they were up there, they continued with their various activities, stealing vehicles in order to make dune buggies, lighting fires, setting fires to various forestry department equipment, and it was this activity which eventually brought Manson back to the attention of authorities. They're up there at the ranch, they're doing all of this stuff, the heat is unbearable, and they are running out of food and water and other supplies. Members of the family, not the core members, but those who were really more than hanger-ons, began to grow disillusioned with Manson and his beliefs. Manson attempted to get them to stop and to stay with them, but eventually a group of his followers fled Barker Ranch and went down to a small town nearby, at which they informed the authorities that Manson and his followers were staying up at the ranch. Some accounts state that they told authorities that Manson had completely lost his mind. At this point, it was decided that they needed to raid Barker Ranch. So, on October 10th, the California Highway Patrol, members of the Inyo County Sheriff's Department, and members of the National Park Service law enforcement rangers went up and raided the Barker Ranch, where they arrested some of the members of the family. However, they did not get Manson. On October 12th, they went back and raided again. They were just getting ready to leave, having not located Manson, when a sheriff's deputy noticed a clump of hair sticking out from underneath of a sink basin. This is the kind that had dual doors on it, the little box underneath like you might see in your home. And upon opening the double doors on this basin, discovered Charles Manson hiding. Were it not for his hair getting caught in the door, it is very doubtful that Manson would have been arrested at this period of time. So Manson and his followers, again, not all of them, because some of them, as they often did, fluttered in and out of the family's various camps, were arrested and taken into custody on charges of destruction of government property and auto theft. Meanwhile, other members of the family fled the area, most notably Tex Watson, who would eventually be located down in Texas. When they were arrested, again, it was just on auto theft charges and destruction of government property. Law enforcement had no idea that Manson and his followers were responsible for the Tate-LaBianca murders. There are those out there who believe that that particular line is a bit of a fabrication and that law enforcement were tipped off by Manson's handlers who had grown fearful and disgusted over the things that he had been doing and decided that the experiment that was Charles Manson and his family needed to be brought to a close. I personally don't believe that particular line of thinking. But anyways, they're arrested. Officers have no idea who it is that they have in their possession. The police began looking into various aspects of Manson's family at this period of time. Now, according to Vince Bugliosi, members of the sheriff's department, I should say, learned that Manson had contacts with the motorcycle gangs. Some sources state that they were Satan's slaves, others that they were known as the Straight Satans. Anyways, supposedly members of the LaBianca task force began talking to members of this motorcycle gang under the belief that there was a possible connection to Manson and his followers and the crime at the LaBianca household. It was from this group that the detectives became aware of the murder of Gary Hinman, and upon questioning the bikers, they learned that there was a possible connection with Manson and this murder. Specifically, they learned that Susan Atkins was most likely involved in it. Atkins was already in jail at this period of time. When pressed by sheriff's department officials as to whether or not she had been present during the Hinman murder, Atkins readily admitted that she was involved in it. At this point, Atkins was booked for the murder of Gary Hinman and was moved to the Sybil Brand Institute in Monterey Park. This next point has been, there's been some debate as to whether or not this actually happened or not, or whether it's a fabrication of prosecutor Vince Bagliosi. Supposedly, while at Sybil Brandt, Atkins began boasting to her bunkmates, Ronnie Howard and Virginia Graham, that she was involved in both the Tate and LaBianca murders and had details concerning them both that the authorities were unaware of. If I'm not mistaken, it was Ronnie Howard who went to authorities and informed them of this, at which point authorities told her to go back and get further information from Atkins, which both of the women did. It should be noted, I believe both Howard and Graham were in jail for either drug or prostitution charges, one or the other, and that many have stated that they went to the authorities with this information, not out of a matter of conscience, but because of the reward that had been offered by Roman Polanski in regards to the murder of his wife. I believe it was something to the tune of $25,000, which in 1969 was a large amount of money. When I say there, this particular bit of information is something of a sticking point, there is some information that indicates that the two women were actually fed information by law enforcement and told to go and basically entrap Atkins concerning her possible involvement with this crime. And there's also been speculation that the officers fed the two women some of this information. Whether or not that is true, I have no idea. But as with every aspect of this case, it's worth mentioning in case you want to go and investigate it yourself. This way you can draw your own conclusions for it. I personally don't believe that the two women were as innocent as they made themselves out to be and have continued to make themselves out to be. I do believe that law enforcement may have fed them some information after Atkins made her first confession, if that's what we can call it, to one of these women. I think that they gave them some information in order to elicit more information from Susan. For those of you who are Manson files, you'll notice that I did skip over a portion of the activities out at Death Valley National Park, and that is because we are going to be getting into that in some detail when we get to their actual trials, and I didn't feel like picking it apart in this episode. We are going to leave our story at this point for this week, as next week we're going to be getting into the indictments and all of the various shenanigans that surrounded the trials of Charles Manson and members of his family. So until next week, if you enjoy the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform, leave a 5-star review, come and join the Deathcast Facebook page. Click on like. I post stuff near almost daily. Most of it is what can best be described as dark humor, with here and there information about various cases that are going on currently. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.